General Richards Reel 4. I was asking you how numerous within the 4th Battalion were personnel who had served with tanks during the war. You've told me about the new entrants. I wonder how many of the old World War I tank corps personnel were still serving in the battalion and in what kind of positions.
They were mostly the subaltern rank, and there were very few of them, really. Small percentage, I think, probably might have been 5 or 6%, not many more. And they're all junior ranks. The officers I'm talking about. The other ranks, I don't think there are any. There might have been one or two. I don't remember any of them.
What kind of people were holding the more senior ranks in the battalion then?
They were ex-officers from infantry battalions, usually. The ones I'm thinking of are practically all infantry.
It suggests that the higher echelon of the battalion's officers had little practical experience of tanks
No, they
themselves.
hadn't, no. Very little. But they'd obviously come to the regiment because of a blockage and promotion in their own regiments. That was the snag of the whole thing.
That doesn't sound as if it was necessarily a very good reason from the tank corps' point of view.
No, I don't suppose it
I
was.
mean,
But that's the way they came. And a lot of very good fellows came too.
did the lack of experience in tanks at the higher levels create any problems in the battalion?
I don't think so. I don't think so at all.
That rather surprises me.
Yes, it probably does. But as you see, you had your technical officer and your edge, so young fellows are pretty well experienced in these things. And the only things I think they probably failed in, really, were the senior officers who had to do the technical training. And I think probably we might have been taught on the wrong lines in many ways.
Can you make that a bit clearer?
Well, it's rather difficult to do so. I'll tell you why. Because, you see, there were two lines of thought. And one was during the war, tanks and infantry worked close together, and the tanks' job was to support the infantry onto their positions and so on. The other line of thought was the tanks to be almost independent and on the thrust line and so on, and exploiting mobility. And they were the two lines of thought. And it depended on the commanding officer and the senior officers which line you're going to take. And in the 4th Tanks, where I was, we did the infantry close support tactical view of the whole thing, which was, in my case, a great advantage. But then you had the other battalions in the south exercising as a brigade on the Salisbury Plain in 37 and 38 when I was brigade major of them, and we were doing a kind of mobile operation in warfare, and that is quite a different cup of fish, kettle of fish.
You had by this time received the Vickers Medium.
That's right.
What sort of impact did that make on arrival after being more familiar with the old
Well, it's
Mark
much more
Fives?
mobile and so on, much more mobile, and we get about the countryside much quicker and so on. But they were never a tank that you could ever take to battle. I mean, they were just. The armor was too thin, the gun was inadequate, and so on. I mean, you couldn't think of anything worse for warfare, really. But they were very good for training purposes. They were mobile, which is the chief thing.
Did the fact that you were now training with a very much more sophisticated tank than you'd previously had call for any modification or adaptation in your training procedures?
Well, I don't think so. Because, as I was saying, we spent our time in the 4th Tanks training in support of infantry, and we continue to do so. But if I had gone south and joined one of the other battalions, like the 1st, 2nd, or 3rd, I should find myself rather at sea to start with, because they operated more or less on their own, mm. without infantry and other forms of support.
Mm. Curious thing, although you had this new tank, a much more sophisticated one than the Mark V's, mm. I suppose you could argue that really the Mark V's were in some ways rather more suited to an infantry support role than the Vickers mediums.
Not really. I tell you why, because you see, the Vickers medium had a turret on it, and the gun was the first thing that appeared over the skyline. Well, you see, with a you're taking up a position on a hull down position to support the infantry and so on, and that was a much better position to be in than crawling across the open with the infantry being shot at by everything you can see at and see you from all directions. And the guns were not on the top of the tank, they were at the side of the tank, so you had to expose the tank before you could fire. So really, from the point of view of a support of infantry, the Vickers tank was better, really, from that point of view, from our point of view. You see, the snag was this, really, that everybody fired the tank, and so the infantry got as far away from them as they possibly could. Well, that was the wrong principle entirely, you see, because they wanted to get support from the tanks, and the tank could rush forward, get into a hull-down position, and support the infantry whilst they move through.
Yes, I can certainly see the advantage of the turreted tank as against the one with the side sponsons, but on the other hand, at least the Mark V moved at about the pace of an infantry soldier, whereas the Vickers was very much faster.
Yes, I agree with you there, but that was the point I'm bringing out about the infantry not being very friendly with the tank, because it didn't want to get anywhere near a tank, because everybody is firing at the tank. And so they got in the way of fire, and they didn't like that. Mm. They used to try and hide behind it and so on.
Much of your training in infantry support role, you've told me, was with the 5th Infantry Division. And at this time, the man in charge of the division was GFC Fuller.
No. General Kirk was in charge of the division. JFC Fuller was in charge of one of the brigades.
Uh-huh. I see.
He was in charge of one of the brigades of the 5th Division.
Ah. Well, the question I wanted to ask you was, in view of Fuller's pioneering work with tanks, did this make for easier cooperation with
Yes, he was a great boost for us, you see, because he knew more about tanks than most of us knew anything about them at all, and he was a great boost in our line. And when we did operations with his brigade and so on, well, I mean, we were given a proper job to do. And he could always argue with the senior officers on very sound foundation on the pros and cons of what we're doing. Oh no, he was a great fillip to us in the regiment.
Was he a great boost for you merely by virtue of being there, or did he involve himself very much in the planning of training?
Oh, he involved himself in the training. You see, he would get a brigade training, and he would include the tanks in them. You see.
Mm. So you would have come across him from time to time during this period.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
What sort of impression did he make on you as a man?
Well, I met him before, as a matter of fact, in various ways and so on, and we had the greatest admiration for the fella, because we believed in everything he was preaching. That's what it really meant to him. And he was a kind of demigod to us, because we only had a few of those on our side, and he was one of them. The other one, people, a little hard, you hear.
In a way, what Fuller was preaching was against the sort of role that you were carrying out at the time. I wonder if that came
Oh,
over.
no, 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 he was all for that role as well. He understood both roles.
Did he?
Oh, yes, he understood the both all right.
I thought he was very exclusively occupied with the concept of the use of
well,
large,
that's
independent...
Well, that's what he preached tremendously, for the simple reason that nobody else would believe in it, and he was trying to put it over and so on, emphasize the thing. Mm. But he was very much pro-infantry tank corporation. For instance, I remember at one exercise at Kettrick, we attacked a position which was being held by the enemy, and with our tanks, and we got onto the position before the barrage, our own barrage, had teared off it. And so he was rather criticized by General Kirk for getting them out. And he said, not a bit of it, not a bit of it. He said, the tanks are quite immune to all that artillery fire. What's worrying about them? The infantry followed up and got on the position. Oh no, he was always very keen on that type of warfare, but he didn't have to emphasize it because that's the type of thing we've been doing during the war. Mm. Now, people understood that, but they didn't understand this other business.
He had a bit of a reputation for being a rather abrasive kind of character. Did you find him easy to get along with?
Oh yes, we found him very easy to get along with. So on. He was very, we spent a lot of time with him and so on. And he was a great critic of ours. I remember one time one of our squadron leaders, our company commanders as he was in those days, got some of his tanks bogged around Kettrick. Well, you know, all those moors around Kettrick are very boggy. And this fellow was saying, at this conference, he said he was sorry, but his tanks had got bogged and so on. So a fellow said, well, they shouldn't get bogged. What have you been given that little ash stick for? We all carry ash sticks, you see. And the object of the ash stick was to push it in the ground to see if the ground was suitable for tanks or not. And he said, if you'd gone along with your ash stick beforehand and made quite sure the ground was all right, you wouldn't have had your tanks bogged.
Mm. Yeah. That's interesting. Yes, that's very interesting. I suppose all the time then, you were sort of aware of him kind of looking over your shoulder a bit.
Oh, yes.
And things you might have got away with some infantry officers.
Yeah. You wouldn't have got away straight away. But you see, he knew that he had been with the tanks during the First World War. He was a G2 to General Ellis.
Now, in the actual training with the 5th Infantry Division, how at the beginning was that organized and carried out, your joint training exercises?
Well, I suppose they were instigated by the divisional headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
But it was carried out in the normal way, as far as I go, with umpires and things like that. In one exercise we did, two or three day exercise, in the division, one of our umpires was the chief umpire was our second in command, who happened to be then General Hubbard, and he was a full colonel then, and he was the chief umpire. The commanding officer of the battalion was a fellow called Festing, who was a lieutenant colonel, so it made it a bit difficult.
Yes. What were the initial reactions of infantry soldiers to working with tanks? Because presumably many of them wouldn't have had this experience.
Oh, I just don't know. I just don't know what the reaction was.
Last time you were suggesting that they thought that tanks were sort of wonderful machines that could kind of do anything, and you had to teach them that they couldn't do anything.
Yes, I think that might be true. Yes, I think that's possibly true. They thought that was probably the be end of everything, and that was they didn't do anything about it. But General Lindsay was a great teacher in that line, I think, you see. He was in the machine gun corps during the war. He's a green jacket, really. And he came off the war and was a tremendous teacher, I thought, in the tank line. He reckoned, you see, what you did was you attacked with your tanks and infantry and your machine guns, and then you established yourself on a line with your machine guns and infantry, and then withdrew the tanks. And in a battle, you did that, and if you were counterattacked by tanks, then you should take them on. But you see, if you only turned around and said, replace the machine gun or implement the machine gun with the anti-tank gun, you'd have got exactly what the Germans were doing, what they taught to do, and what they did on the desert, and what they did in Northwest Europe with their anti-tank guns. The enemy tanks didn't fight our tanks. It was the German anti-tank guns that fought our tanks. Eh? We hadn't got any anti-tank guns.
Were you aware of this deficiency at this time, in the mid-20s? Had it occurred to you?
No.
No.
At least I wasn't, but other people might have been.
In the training programs with the infantry, were you aware of there being any difference in the kind of tactics that had been employed in the First World War for the same purpose?
No, I wasn't really, because, you see, I wasn't really involved in infantry tactics in the First World War. I found myself in cavalry division all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't come near the infantry at all.
Did you meet any prejudices amongst the infantry units you work with against tanks?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
You would meet prejudices at, shall I say, lectures and things like that.
Can you give me any examples?
No, I can't really. But I can't offhand give you any examples. But you would get lectures, and you would know the feeling of the thing was really anti-tank, really. By the various questions answered and put forward and so on.
Mm.
Very often that happened. And they were definitely anti-tank, especially the cavalry people. And I can well understand them, because they were frightened of having their horses taken away.
Yeah. Yes. Now, taking it from the point when the force for Shanghai was formed in the UK, perhaps you could start there.
Well, the Armoured Car Company was the 5th Armoured Car Company, which was stationed in Scarborough. And they were ordered out to China. And they went up to strength in officers. And so they asked for volunteers. And I volunteered to go. And I joined them in Scarborough. And after about a month there, we embarked, I think it was in January 27, at Liverpool. For Shanghai in a ship called the SS Bellerophon, which was really a cargo ship. And we had on board, besides our armored cars, we took our armored cars with us, of course, besides our armored cars, a horsed mountain battery of gunners. And so we had about 150 horses on board besides the armored cars. And they were a bit of a nuisance, because they kept on getting stuff, a thing called staggers the whole time. The minute they got staggers, they had to be chucked overboard, because they couldn't cure them. Added to which, our mess quarters and sleeping quarters were in the coal bunkers down below. And these chaps were mucking out in the mornings. If you didn't close your portholes and the wind was the wrong way, you got all the muck on your beds and so on, which was rather unpopular. But anyway, it took us 6 weeks to get to Shanghai. And we got to Shanghai, and we disembarked there. And they were in the process, we had to go into tents, because there are no wooden sheds for us, which we did. At a place called I wish I could remember, but I think it was called Yangtze Po. It was a suburb of Shanghai, and we were there. And it's an international settlement, you know, and every nationality was represented there. There's a French settlement, then they had a settlement of their own. Then all the other settlements were all mixed up, like the British and the Japanese and the Russian and the Dutch and so on, really, and Portuguese. And this settlement had to be protected from the Chinese outside, who were warring between one another, and Chiang Kai-shek being the chief exponent of this. And the idea was they could war as much as they liked, so they didn't get into the international settlement, because the business there was fantastic. And so our job was to really prevent any Chinese warring elements getting into the city. And each nationality had a different sector to look after. Well, we were the only armored cars there, except the kind of territorial armored car unit there, which was a local armored car unit. And so we had the job of really patrolling the whole of the international settlement, which in time gave us a very good idea of the whole of Shanghai. We knew it backwards, on the side streets and everything we could think of. And we patrolled. We'd have a patrol out every night, looking around these various places, and we hardly ever struck any trouble at all. We only had one bit of trouble, where one fella, his name was Newman, took his section up a cul-de-sac, and he got stuck in this cul-de-sac and got fired on by the Chinese. And one or two were wounded, including the officer in charge and so on, but they got the cars out all right in the end. But that's the only bit of trouble we had in Shanghai.
Does that bit of trouble reveal anything about the deficiencies of armored cars for this kind of...
Well, yes, armored cars are not really meant for that job. They're not meant for that job at all, internal security. They had a great moral effect, of course, on everybody, but they are very vulnerable when you think of it. In fact, what we used to do, the Chinese used to try and jump on the cars, so we electrocuted the car.
How'd you do that?
Well, you could do that through the sparking plugs in the battery, you see, and so on. Anybody touched the armor, and you were standing on the road, standing on the ground, you got you got a nasty shock, yeah? Especially in the wet weather. But if you were in the car, you were insulated from that shock by the tires, of course. And after the first 6 months, when we had to go about fairly well armed and so on, things quietened down a lot, and patrolling was relaxed, and we spent the next 18 months just waiting for trouble, which we never got.
There being an international force there during that period, and your cars being the only armored cars in Shanghai, did they excite much interest from foreign national...
Oh, yes, especially people like the Japanese and so on. The Japanese eventually turned up in their sector. They produced some crossly armored cars, you see, which is very interesting because they'd been made with us. But they were very keen on us not looking inside them and having a look at them. They wouldn't let us anywhere near them because they thought they'd be giving some secrets away. Well, we made the damn things, we knew all about them. But otherwise, there was a Shanghai Defense Force, you know, a local force, which had armored cars. They were locally made armored cars and things like that. And they were a very good crowd.
Were they operated by Tank Corps personnel?
No, they were operated by their own Shanghai people, local volunteers. Mm-hmm. I've forgotten the name of the fellow in charge of them, but there's one fellow amongst them called Newton, I remember him. But they were a good crowd, and we cooperated with them a lot.
In what kind of ways did you cooperate?
Well, they would split up patrolling with them occasionally and things like that. And we had plans that if there were any serious trouble in any sector, they'd come and help us and so on.
So the frontier patrolling work was totally peaceful.
Absolutely peaceful, yes. I mean, we patrolled all the streets, and the there was a great road called the Western Road, which led out to all the big houses and all the big Chinese merchants, who happened to be usually British. They'd evacuated their houses because of trouble, and we spent our time looking after them. I lived for about 6 weeks in a house owned by people called Liddell rather, and they left everything as it was. You see, the Chinese servants and everything had left. I lived on like a local king.
Sounds a bit like a modification of 19th century imperial policy, whereby instead of sending a gunboat, you send an armored
In
car.
an armored car, yes. Funnily enough, the Liddells are now living quite close here.
That's curious.
The old lady, they've all died except the old lady who is still there. But the family are there, of course.
Talking of Liddell, how would you assess the contribution of Liddell Hart during this period we've been talking about in furthering the cause of the tank corps and of tanks generally?
Oh, I think he was a leading element in it. I mean, he was one of the, he was a, I should thought he is a great exponent of it. I mean, he was a man who could put down in paper in readable fashion what we were all thinking in theory and so on. And
He was successful in doing that, was
oh,
he?
very
Did you feel he
successful.
represented you well?
Yes, he did, yeah. Later on in the war, I found myself staff captain on the experimental brigade on the Sorby Plain, and that's the first time I met him there. I'd heard of Liddell Hart, but I'd never seen him or so on. And that's the first time I met him. Oh, yes, he did a tremendous lot of good to us. I think he preached the right theory, too. The Germans listened to him, of course, but we didn't.